I'll tell you, let's go ahead and get started.
I guess this is for recording, not for talking loud. So I tend to walk around a lot. And I can do it as a speech, but more, I think, more productive for everyone is more of a Q&A. So do interrupt me. And I've got this, I think we've got about a full hour, right? So we'll be plenty of time for Q&A, and you can grab me afterwards if you'd like to talk as well. So let me introduce myself. My name is Bill Bostransky. I'm the head of the Adoption Division in the Office of Children's Issues at the Department of State. I'm a Foreign Service officer, so a career Foreign Service officer, so that means most of my career is spent working overseas. I'm a consular specialist, so what that means is most of my time is either serving American citizens who are in trouble overseas, whether they're in prison, whether they're in hospital, or also working on visa issues, and part of that is adoptions and adoption advocacy overseas, and I've done a couple of tours on that. I've served in Moscow for, it seems like just oh so many years. I think we did 5 years altogether, two tours out there. My next tour overseas is going back to Moscow, clearly for my sins. I've served in Havana, Cuba, so we don't have an embassy there, but it's the U.S. interest section of the Swiss embassy. My wife always said she wanted to marry a suave European diplomat. That's the closest she could get. And then in Kyiv, Ukraine, and in the Dominican Republic, done 3 Washington tours, and including the one I'm in right now as the head of the Adoption Division. So that's a little bit about me. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the environment of intercountry adoption. There's a lot of talk about the Hague Convention. I live it and breathe it every day, but I wanted to give you a little bit of familiarity to what that is. I know some of the agencies, of course, are going to know a lot about it. It's still fairly new for the United States, but we'll go into that a bit. The non-convention environment, which is the rest of the world, including Russia, Ethiopia, for example, 2 big countries, talk a little bit about the process, but not so much, because I want to give you resources on how to find out more, because the general stuff isn't going to do you much good. You're going to need to know how it applies to your particular situation. So I want to teach you how to go get that information later on. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the environment on intercountry adoption, and then how to, some tools you can use to help navigate that. Does that sound fair? A lot to cover. Please do ask a lot of questions as we go through. I feel like I'm on a dog on a line here. Okay, so first thing, intercountry adoption. You've got to have 3 sort of legal infrastructures all aligning up. So you've got the laws of the country of origin of the child. And the term generally is country of origin. There's actually a lot of debate about what's the right term, but that's kind of a neutral term. That's real important because that child is of that country, will always be from that country, and in almost all cases will always retain that country's citizenship. So that country will always have an interest in that person. In the best of circumstances, those countries care deeply about these kids and act to protect that child's best interest. That's not always the case, and you need to be aware of that as you go out and try and choose which country program you're looking into. The U.S. federal laws and regulations, first and foremost, is the Immigration and Nationalities Act, because, in essence, adopting a child overseas is, in a way, like marrying a foreign national or bringing your brother, sister, parent, foreign national into the country. A lot of the same things apply. So the Immigration and Nationalities Act is going to be something, basically visa law. You're going to have to learn a little bit about that. Good agency is going to help you through a lot of this. The Intercountry Adoption Act, that really is the defining law that governs a lot of the way we interact with the Hague Adoption Convention. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The Child Citizenship Act, it's one of the key laws in the sort of pantheon of adoption legislation that protects these children. and that under if certain conditions are met, the child automatically receives U.S. citizenship. It's shocking to me, actually, in what year are we in, 2010 now, that still some parents end up going through the system and don't ensure that their adopted children have U.S. citizenship. Horrible things can happen. You know, they're a college sophomore and they're experimenting with marijuana or something, trying it the first time, they could get deported and never be able to come back to the country if you don't take care of this early. The intent of the Child Citizenship Act is to protect those kids as they grow up, and it automatically does it in many cases, but in still some cases you need to make sure that that you as the adopted parent take some action later on down the road. Again, a good agency is going to make sure that you've got that covered. I'm shaking my finger at you in a friendly way, of course. Department of State regulations. These are the implementing regulations for both the, you know, depending on whether you're in a convention country or not, also a lot of the regulations surrounding visa issues, and the Department of Homeland Security regulations. It's important to remember that as you do this, there are two agencies in the U.S. government that are going to work. We work very closely together. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, you know, when you file your I-600, I-800, that's who your home study is going to. And then the overseas portion of it, which is the State Department, which is the adoption advocacy overseas and the, but when the rubber hits the road for you guys, the actual visa process. And then, of course, the third part of this triad is the state laws and regulations. So who can adopt in that state? What are the requirements for a home study in that state? Are there any other particulars? And there are 54 answers to that between the U.S. states and territories. It's all a little bit different. This is where a good agency is going to make a big difference. These are all things you're going to have to consider. So in the country requirements, each country is going to be different. Okay, here, everyone write down adoption.state.gov. It is the website where we maintain a lot of information on particular country programs that's updated. And then if you want to fade in and out of the conversation from here on in, as long as you've got adoption.state.gov at the written down right now, you can go back and figure out how that stuff that guy was talking about applies to me, because that's really going to matter, whether you're looking at Russia or whether you're looking at Ukraine or whether you're looking at China or somewhere else. But each country the child is a Chinese child, a Russian child. They have absolute full authority. Their laws fully apply there. They determine which children are eligible to be adopted, who in that country can adopt. And different countries have different rules, just like different states in the United States have different rules. This is a key one when you get down into the details, whether it's a full and final adoption decree or whether it is a custody for the purposes of adoption. It's an important element because that plays back into the Child Citizenship Act. Who's considering adopting from India? Okay. One of the things that you need to look at is the Indian law, the Juvenile Justice Act. You'll want to write that one down because it's an Indian law that's not being fully applied equally across the country that plays right into this point. And if it's applied in India, your child would become an automatic U.S. citizen. If it's not applied, you're going to have a lot of follow-up down the road. Or if you fail to do that, your child could be vulnerable when he or she becomes an adult. So each country is different. And, of course, the process. And it's going to vary, again, dramatically from country to country. You want to know a little more about that, adoption.state.gov, ask your adoption service provider. Whether adoptive parents must visit or live with the child prior to the adoption, many countries allow foreigners to adopt, but you have to live with the child under some sort of foster arrangement for a year, 2 years prior to it. Well, who can take 2 years off? Why, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? You can't. So, in actuality, many of these countries are closed to inter-country adoption because of that requirement. Now, different child welfare experts will give you different opinions on whether that's the best practice or not. But many countries decide, based on their laws and regulations, which are derived from their history with adoption, their history with child welfare, their cultural background, on whether they feel that an adoptive parent needs to be closely supervised through the adoption process or not. Yeah, so main thing, see, it's right there, adoption.state.gov, and for anyone who might have missed me saying it, I think, three times. We talk a lot about the Hague Convention. Hague Convention was drafted and finalized in 1993. There are now 81 countries that are members of the convention. We, the United States, are very new to the convention. It went into force only in April of 2008. So we're coming up on 2 years pretty soon. It governs the inter-country adoptions between these countries and sets forth a series of principles. I'll go into those a little bit more, but it is in this structure, there's a lot more safeguards for both the child, the biological parents of the child, and the adoptive parents. And you will see that play out in some people call red tape or paperwork, but it's really important because it's how, as you go through the process, either to adopt a child from a convention country to the United States, or when the United States is the country of origin. And yes, foreigners adopt our kids because there are, by some counts, 100,000 American children that need parents today, and they're not getting them here, so that is happening as well. And so us as a receiving country, those foreign families who want to adopt our children also have to go through these same, through safeguards that are roughed out in the convention and then defined by the laws of the two countries and the regulations. Yeah?
What are the main countries that are adopting?
Convention countries, I would say Netherlands, Canada, United Kingdom. I expect we're going to see growth in France, Italy in the future. They both expressed a strong interest in adopting from the foster care programs in the United States. And for, keep in mind, inter-family adoption is considered a best practice in many circumstances. And so because of that, you'll probably see a large number of, in the future, going forward, Mexican, Peruvian, Brazilian, Dominican, where there's large cross, where there's large hyphenated communities, you know, Brazilian-American, Dominican-American. Now, again, if you want to know if the country you're interested in adopting in is convention or not, it's on our website. Your adoption service provider should be able to provide you more information on it. In that context, you are looking at the forms are called the I-800A and the I-800. Boy, they love those I forms and the names of them. It is confusing as you're coming at it the first time, but just to know what their intent is, they run parallel to the non-convention. The I-800A is determining the suitability and eligibility of you as an adoptive parent. Generally, the bulk of it is the home study, which keeps coming up. The I-800, and then over on the non-convention side, the I-600 talks about you and the child. Is that a valid and legal match, and then can that child come to the United States? The visas have slightly different names. It is an alphabet soup of visas, by the way. IH is the Hague visas. IRs are the non-convention visas. And the 3 and 4, the difference is roughly full and final adoption and a custody order for the purposes of adoption. Same thing plays out over on the non-convention side. So non-convention, you see that there's less U.S. regulation and law involved. Just the Immigration and Nationality Act, the Child Citizenship Act. The definition is slightly different, the legal definition. In a way, actually in a very real way, the definition of convention adoptee is broader than the definition of orphan. Different form numbers, it's a little bit more streamlined, though I bet if you've been through it, you wouldn't agree with me on that. And then the visa at the end is slightly different. But there's a parallel. Just know that on the convention side, there's a lot more safeguards, both in the country of origin and on the U.S. side. I've mentioned over and over full and final adoptions versus a custody for the purposes of adoption. And it really comes down to what the court in the country of origin is determining. From a child protection and child welfare point of view, a full and final adoption is so much preferable. Not only are you able to take advantage of the Child Citizenship Act that I mentioned, that child is your legal child. Legally, there's an equivalency with a child that is your biological child. And that creates so many safeguards. Otherwise, you're bringing a child back, and then you have to go through another adoption process and basically then an extra step to finalize this immigration status. All very doable, and people do it every day, no problem. My office and I see cases regularly where parents failed to do this, failed to do the right thing by their kids, and the kids get in trouble later down the road, and there's sadly not much that can be done for them if their parents have failed them for 12, 15 years. There's some tragedies, which the Child Citizenship Act was supposed to avert, but parents need to take some steps. It's better when it's automatic. I'm going to go into the convention. Got the lawyers here. What is the difference between a convention and a treaty?
That's a great question.
It is a good question. That's why I asked the law students. There really isn't one. Generally, a convention is a treaty, but it's used in a multilateral sense. Damn. Okay, it's up there. So it's like a treaty between us and 81 other countries. And what it does is it establishes norms. It is fairly roughly written. You can get it on our website. Actually, for those of you who are law students, it'll be interesting to look at, because you'll say, well, that doesn't tell us a lot. It creates a framework. And some of the key elements that it creates is this joint common vision, that the prevention of the abduction, sale, or traffic in children. It sounds so obvious, doesn't it? But it creates this obligation, a treaty obligation. A focus on the best interests of the children. This is right up there in the preamble of the convention and actually plays out in multiple articles of the convention. Increased protections for, and we've got to remember, all three parts of the adoption triad. It's first and foremost the child. It's all about, should every time you think about a decision in intercountry adoption, say, okay, we should be thinking about what is best for this child first and foremost. The birth family, they don't disappear. They're usually right there. And, of course, the adoptive family. And this last point is sometimes thick. Sometimes it's so thick that we've created in the international community and the adoption community, the term called subsidiarity. Has anyone heard that term before? I know a couple of you probably have. Subsidiarity is this general principle that in the best interest of the child, you want to try and keep a child, you want to try and preserve the family so that a child does not have to be abandoned or for the million ways that families fall apart, end up without family. You know, I think of the opening line of Anna Karenina, you know, every happy family is happy in the same way, every miserable or unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. There's a lot of unhappy stories out there. But the first goal is to try and make that family work. If that's not possible, then to find kinship solutions or solutions in their own community or ethnic group. And if that's not possible, intercountry adoption is a valid tool to find a permanent family for a child. And all of these options are preferable to long-term institutionalization. Again, sounds obvious to me, but it's, you know, go back into the time of this convention drafting. These were fairly progressive and forward-leaning ideas. We're talking the genesis of these concepts are back in the mid to late 80s into the early 90s when it finally gets turned into a codified form. Now, again, a lot of good debate in the United States adoption community and around the world on how this plays out, this concept of subsidiarity and how it's balanced with the concept of best interest of the child. Countries you want to look at. If you're thinking of the convention, here's a long list. You notice a lot of this, you don't hear a lot of people adopting from Luxembourg. But remember, it's about inter-country adoption, children moving from one habitual resident to another. Back to the law students, what's the definition of habitual residence? There isn't one. It depends. And it depends on the circumstances. The nice thing is the U.S. law and regulations defines that the court who has jurisdiction in the case makes that determination. But remember, we are one of the few on here that can be considered both a receiving country and a country of origin. Though I can tell you we've adopted, since the convention, children from the United Kingdom, France, but we have children going there. It's, again, best interest to the child, finding a lot of these are kinship adoptions. A lot of them are children out of foster care. Two of these I have, there should be two on here. Well, all right, let's talk about Guatemala just briefly. Guatemala is a convention country that in December of 2007, they basically stopped an old and very flawed system of adoption, which did not have a large role for, there were not a lot of safeguards in it at all. And they wanted to join the convention. They've taken a long, long time working to get there. And it's the families that were caught in this have gone through just seemingly interminable process trying to finalize their adoptions. We are now, what is today? It's February of 2010. Guatemala is finally ready to move forward and start a pilot program under the convention, under the Hague Convention. As a matter of fact, yesterday, towards close of business, we sent our proposal to be one of the countries that wants to participate in this pilot program. And congratulations, you're the first public audience I've said that to. I've said it to members of Congress, stakeholder groups, and the agent and Hague-accredited agencies, but you're the first public group. It's going to be very narrowly defined by a small group of kids. We'll see if the United States, given our history in Guatemala, will be accepted as one of the four countries. We certainly hope we are, and we think we have a strong we submitted a strong questionnaire. Keep in mind, maybe we can take that offline. We don't choose the agencies. The agency is going to be chosen by the Guatemalan central authority. Based on their criteria, we're asked to narrow it to a number. And I can, yeah, the answer is yes, we did that for them. They have the ones that fit best their criteria. And they'll let us know whether the United States is in and whether which of the agencies was chosen. Cambodia, also a long history of problematic intercountry adoption back in the late 90s, stopped intercountry adoption in 2001, joined the convention with no legal infrastructure, no regulations, no staff. We can't work in that environment. The convention makes certain obligations, and Cambodia wasn't meeting it. Now, interestingly, in the last several months, they've come a long way. They've finalized the draft of their law, created their law, and the king signed it about 2 months ago. Now they've already got some of the regulatory infrastructure in place. They have a long way to go still, but they've made great progress, and we hope to see some intercountry adoption starting from Cambodia. I can't predict the time, but we're watching Cambodia and interacting with them very actively because I think they're moving in the right direction. I've got Kenya highlighted up here a little bit because Kenya's convention member signed on, but then there was a government change, and there seems to be some ambiguity about whether the new government wants to continue with the previous obligations. I'm a visual thinker, so here's the countries. You notice some important countries of origin on there for the United States. China, India, Philippines, Colombia, all on there. It's we hope to see when, as countries become ready, that they would expand. You ask, well, Bill, that's red, and I know what white is. What's yellow? Yellow are countries that have signed the convention but not yet ratified them. I see someone seeing Russia in yellow up there. Yeah, that's that'll be the next couple of years of my life, but trying to work on that issue. They actually, ironically, for as difficult as it is politically to ratify the convention in the Gosduma in Russia, their system is very consistent with the Hague Convention. They wouldn't actually have to do a lot of changes. And I say that because, you know, as a prospective adoptive parent, you're thinking, I want to make sure that my child was truly adoptable, was not the, his or her parents weren't coerced to give him up, or even some of the worst stories that are out there. And at least on that element in Russia, you can have a fairly high confidence. Now, there's corruption in a myriad of other aspects of it, but it very little goes back to the definition of the child as an orphan. I mentioned it's a fairly new... oh, no, this didn't get updated. That's funny. This is an old slide. It's October 2009, and that's wrong, because we're no longer there. I apologize for that. We're well over 1,000 now. The convention's new for us. People could only start the process of the convention in April of 2008. And, yeah, we're well over 1,000, and several other countries have been added onto it since in the last 4 months. We, you know, we jealously we jealously marked every case that came on that in the beginning. And now another 100 we hardly notice. It's become kind of normal. So, but I think it's a good thing. One of the safeguards in the convention for the United States is the agencies, for the first time in inter-country adoption history in the United States, had to have accreditation and meet certain standards at the federal level. In non-convention environment, you still don't have to do that. You just have to be licensed to operate in the state you're in. And the accreditation standards were long debated through the early part of this last decade, and they set a pretty high bar for agencies. We have an agency representative here. What is your thought on that, the standards? They were a real screening.
But I think they were where they needed to be.
Yeah. Some argued... some argue that the standards could have been strengthened. I know one area that there's a lot of talk about right now is the 10 hours training. But I also know a lot of the 200 and some accredited adoption service providers, as best practice, do significantly higher than that. Actually, there's a couple out there that advertise they do the bare minimum. I think that you, as a prospective adoptive parent, should look very suspiciously on that. Do you want to do the bare minimum when you're talking about preparation for being a parent of an adopted child? Ask that question if you, as you're making, asking that question as you're considering it. You can see that several were denied. ASP, by the way, Adoption Service Provider. It's a manufactured term to encompass several legal definitions. You call them adoption agencies, right? If you're interested in that list, you can get it again at our website, adoption.state.gov. That rest gets confusing. Just go to the website and navigate from there. There's a whole section on the convention. Another, I think, really important safeguard that in the way the United States implemented the convention, and we base a lot of our implementation enforcement on the complaint registry. So if an accredited agency, if an accredited agency is performing poorly, whether it is through in the preparation process, the home study process, the actual fees, the whole gamut, anyone who has a stake in this can complain. The prospective adoptive parent makes good sense, right? But it can also be State Department. We find out that an agency is operating in an unethical or illegal fashion. It can be the central authority of the country of origin. It can be law enforcement. It could be a state licensing. This is a watchdog structure out there. Now, there are, again, we're fairly new in this, less than 2 years. There are 42 complaints entered as of today. And I make an important distinction between a complaint and a substantiated complaint. We actually have complaints in there that have nothing to do with inter-country adoption, nothing to do with the agency, but they've been named. So a person, do you guys know what the visa lottery is? Someone was denied a visa lottery in a non-convention country, nothing to do with adoption, wanted to complain about it, went into this online vehicle, couldn't find a way to get the complaint to stick without naming an agency, and named one. They can't be held culpable for that in any way, so that's an unsubstantiated complaint. These complaints are being investigated. That one's an easy one to close. Some of these are going to be quite substantial and long-lasting complaints, combined with other information that the agencies are required to submit, combined with questionnaires from the countries where they're operating in. And then in order for that agency to continue operating, they have to maintain these standards. If they drop below them, various adverse actions can be taken. They can be forced to operating in that particular country. They could be forced, they could be told they can't operate in any convention country anymore. This is how the United States has chosen to maintain these standards. And I think as the complaints become substantiated, which is going to be happening, this information will be available and is available for you to look at. Yeah, and right as of today, they're still they're not substantiated as of yet, but I can tell you some of the investigations are looking pretty good. And this is done not by the State Department, but by the accrediting entities. I wanted to talk about, how am I doing on time? I got time. I wanted to talk a little bit about the changing face of intercountry adoption, at least as the United States as a receiving country. I mean, there is also a change, as the significant change from the United States as a country of origin as well. But as a receiving country, we'll talk about why it's happening, but these are the impacts. And as a prospective adoptive parent or as an agency, you need to keep these in mind. More and more, the children are older than they would have been 10, 15 years ago. More special needs children, more sibling groups rather than single children available, and more children coming from institutionalized or traumatized backgrounds. So, two ways to go with this thought. One is, why is this happening? And two is, what do you do about it? I'll try and get both of them. And this is maybe an area for a lot of question and answer. I wanted to show you a little bit about the numbers. This trend line, by the way, if you take it out before 1999, really goes down to the single thousands very quickly. And I can't tell what happened before 1980 or so. But statistically, we've got a big jump, a big growth, and a big decline. Decline starting, 2005, around here. Right around here is where it starts. And there's a lot of interesting stories in that. We've done the best statistical analysis and policy analysis on the last year. But you're looking at from 17,000 in fiscal year 2008 to almost 13,000 in fiscal year 2009. And I speak in terms of fiscal years because I'm a government bureaucrat. And that's a October 1 to September 30 calendar. So that means my kids get the Christmas gifts on September 25th every year. it's that accounting year, and that's how we account. So if you say, well, Columbia says you sent this many kids in 2008, but you're saying it's different, always look at that difference between the calendar year and the fiscal year. And other countries actually do a different fiscal year accounting year sometimes. So but the trend lines all match. Which is another thing worth mentioning, that a lot of this pattern of growth and then decline is seen by a lot of other receiving countries. Now, the United States, traditionally adopts more children internationally than the rest of the world combined. Think about that. Than the rest of the world combined. That's the all of those adoptions between Spain and Russia, between Italy and China, between Canada and Haiti. More than all of that combined. It says, I think, two things. It says we're a big country. There's a lot of us. But two, we have accepted and embraced adoption as part of our society in a way that very few other countries have. And I've done adoption advocacy in multiple countries, and I meet people like you, and the idea of adopting is a natural part of the way Americans view building a family. It's normal. It's not perceived that way everywhere, including many of these countries that are traditional receiving countries. Certainly not true, and sometimes viewed very suspiciously in traditional countries of origin. Let's take a look at that 2008 to 2009 decline. 70% of that decline is Guatemala, which is interesting to note. In Guatemala, a tiny country was sending more kids overseas, like double what China was, a country of 1 billion people. The system was fundamentally corrupt, but there were a lot of Americans and a lot of kids who found a lot of Americans who built their families that way, and a lot of kids who found homes that way. Guatemala stopped this in 2009 or 2007, but they allowed about 3,000 transition cases to continue. About 2,500 have already worked their way through, so there's still 500 families who are still suffering through this. But that decline has dropped. Now they're doing criminal investigations. People are going to jail down there, but still, what about the kids, I ask. So that number declines. Vietnam was also a large country of origin, and that accounts. Well, I'm sorry, I'm getting out of order. So 70% Guatemala, 20% decline from China. Now you're dealing with an adoption program of in the high teens of thousands. China was in the I think it went from like 4,000 to 3,000. That's a big decline for China, but since it's such a heavily weighted country statistically, you see a big decline there. The rest, so it's 70% from Guatemala, 20% from China. The other 10% is Russia, Vietnam. I used to know these down to the single digits, but Russia and Vietnam account for a good part of the rest of it. There's countries increasing during this period as well. You've got Ukraine going up and down. You've got Ethiopia, which has increased 50-fold in 10 years. That's an interesting figure. Just from a mathematical point of view. Yeah.
And can you talk about the issues in Guatemala, what the corruption issues were, and how they're solving those?
Well, the notario system. You know how it's illegal to buy a house and have the broker represent both the buyer and the seller? That's the adoption system they had down there. And so they had private individuals. A notario is a notary. So imagine someone, a notary, which is a more prestigious job in most of Latin America than it is in the United States, and they have more authorities. But it basically someone who's consigned something, able to receive a child from a person, and then for a fee, broker that child to another person. It's illegal in the housing market in the United States for a reason. Think about the fees that were involved in intercountry adoption in Guatemala, and you can see how the system was fundamentally corrupt. Even if they were all angels, it's a bad system. What they've set up is a system where there's a central authority, where there's a government agency that basically is determining which children are available for intercountry adoption. They've had more, by the way, domestic adoptions in Guatemala in the last couple of years than they've probably had in its entire history. So they're trying to promote domestic solutions, but they're never going to solve the needs of all the... No, I won't say never. I hope they will someday solve the needs of all the children domestically, but I don't see it in the very near future. And so they've recognized, and I think rightly so, that they've got children that need to be served through inter-country adoption. And this pilot program, which is hopefully going to be starting up in the next year that I was talking about earlier, is their solution for that. It will never, I suspect, reach those huge numbers that we saw back in 2003 to 2005. It'll probably be in the hundreds rather than the thousands. They are considering it. Ethiopia is an interesting case. There's also huge growth. We think the convention is the best structure out there for a safeguard. But here's the danger. You want to, as we see in Cambodia and in Guatemala, a jump from a fundamentally flawed system to the convention doesn't always serve kids. You know, you want, let me rephrase that, it does serve kids, but sometimes it's not feasible in a way that's a smooth transition. So what you want to do is, from an advocacy point of view, encourage reforms, encourage better safeguards, where in every way that's possible. The Hague Convention is both a political move and a child welfare move. Sometimes politically, like in Russia, it's very difficult to do. And then, as we see, and as Cambodia is really getting the gears moving towards it, there's actually a lot that needs to be done. I know a country that took from 1993 when it signed the convention to 2008 to be able to implement. Can you guess that country? Yeah. This was hard for us. Imagine a country like with less resources and a less active adoption community to be able to do that. So they are considering it. Our position is, yeah, that should be an end goal, but there are all these other safeguards and reforms that you can do in the meanwhile. Ethiopia is kind of a mix. I think that they could be doing a lot more to ensure that the children that are made available for inter-country adoption, that the safeguards are there. You've probably all seen some of the press on that issue, and some which names certain U.S. adoption service providers. I think that there's cause for concern there. But what you don't want is stop it completely, and then wait for perfect. You want better. You want better every day. In Ethiopia, you want significantly better, but you also don't want to lose sight of the best interest of the child completely. This is an important thing. This next topic is one I think is really important for those of you that are considering. Oh, go ahead. Yeah. It's since it is not yet, because this is very fresh news. Actually, I think we put out an announcement that they had announced this. It's all over, by the way, the CNA, the Consejo Nacional de Adopción de Guatemala's website. They've got it all up there. So it was given how bad Guatemala's previous system was, and if you follow Guatemala very closely, you notice that the CNA has had some significant financial problems. There were very sincere and well-justified worries about the capacity in Guatemala. In addition, when they announced the pilot program, they provided almost as close to no details as you could possibly imagine, and that was worrisome. So through the months since then, we've gotten a lot more meat on how they're going to structure it. Are you with an agency? Okay, I was going to say, if you are, it looks like it's going to be pretty close to, very similar to the Colombian system, which is a system I have high confidence in, actually. there's some issues on the edges, but if that's their model, they could do a lot worse. They really could.
Same question also from Russia on the website. Is there information about the status of Russia being at the top?
They've signed, but not ratified. I think we mentioned it up there. I think it's up front that might even be the first sentence on our, but it's in there. It doesn't necessarily matter because, you know, it is or it isn't. And in this case, it isn't. Russia, the concerns in Russia, I'd love to talk about them. I'd love to talk about Russia, and other countries. And I can tell you maybe a little bit of my, I've got a little bit of a crystal ball, and maybe I can give you some of my thoughts, both what I do know, and then I'll caveat what I think. But this is a section that I'd like almost the agencies to focus on more than the prospective adoptive parents, but I want you all to focus on this. And this is choosing an adoption service provider. First, I put independent adoptions up there. It is in a non-convention country. It is still possible to do an independent adoption. Before any of you consider that, and I know there's all these websites that say they'll help you through it and stuff, I want you to really think about that and whether this is a good thing. Let me give you one figure. There have been 15 murders by adoptive parents that killed their kids from Russia. 15 parents killed their children in the last 13 years. 13 of those were independents. Independent probably makes up a quarter or so or less. Historically, you think it's about a quarter? I mean, if you aggregate it, very few now, but if you go back a decade, a lot more. You know, and if you think it's 20 or 30, I'll accept that. Or
it's dropping, right?
And I'm probably somewhat off there. Then why is the vast majority of the children who have, the cases where the children have met just tragedy? Independent. There's something about that. My job, I've always been a passionate advocate of intercountry adoption and something that's close to my heart, and I've made my life, a good part of my life dedicated to this overseas. I thought when I would take this job, I would be dealing with people like you, talking to people with the hopes, trying to help them get through the program. Actually, the majority of a good part of my job, when I say good, I mean bad, but a large part of my job is actually working on cases where the child may not have died but was severely abused, sexually abused, used for pornography by the adoptive parents. We're doing something wrong when this is happening. And again, my information is largely informed by the Russia-Ukraine experience just because of my professional career, at least with working on the adoption issue. And I have to say, if you're thinking about independent adoption or you know someone is, tell them, this is, one, it's complex stuff. But two, we're dealing with a child's life here. And there are very competent professionals out there who can help guide you through this. And I don't represent the adoption industry in any way or the... But this is hard stuff, and you really want to make sure that you have someone to help you navigate the bureaucracy of it, both in the United States and the country of origin. But more importantly, you want to be properly advised and trained on the type of child that you're going to likely adopt, and then you want someone who's going to be able to provide you with a safety and support network afterwards. Parenting's hard. It's just hard. I'm a parent. I have two kids. My daughter says I have to bring back something from Lexington. I don't know what to bring. I'm going to see the campus here in the airport. So I'll find something at the airport. It's just hard. All these little things. Adopting a child, and remember what I said up front, more and more of these children will be older, more special needs, more history of institutionalization or coming from some pretty hard places than anyone us would ever want a child to go through, and you're going to be taking these children into your homes. Parenting's hard enough to begin with, and these are special circumstances. You want to make sure you have a support network, and you're ready for what you've been through. How do you raise a child who has fetal alcohol syndrome? How do you how do you diagnose and identify it? How do you work with a child who has been institutionalized and has trouble connecting and building bonds with other human beings? These are real issues that you may face, and there are people in this country who are just some of the best in the world at helping you with that. You're not going to get that necessarily on your own. So that's my yeah. Depends on the agency and what their services are. This is where it gets to do your homework. Is that the title of this slide? Do your homework. That's what it's supposed to be. Things you can do to find out. You know, and this is general, inside or outside the convention. Go to the Better Business Bureau. It's free. A lot of good info out there. Call your state licensing. In almost all the states, they're going to be the first tier of regulation of the organization. They will make sure that that agency is in compliance. What state are you guys licensed in? Alabama, Georgia, Washington. You're with one.
Same.
Okay. I only got one agency?
Man. Well, I think another point you're making about independent is the accountability on the agencies. You know, when you're talking about the complaint registry, you can't make a complaint against
no one. Yeah. No one. A website that helped you guide you through it. Yeah. Russia in particular. Okay, go to the website. There's great advocacy websites out there, or just adopted parents' websites. And a lot of them are regional or country-specific. I don't recommend or not recommend any of them. I recommend you go and you do your homework and find out what's out there. There's loads of information. When I was a consular officer overseas, this may be a trick that you want to think about, is every day I was on those websites reading what people were saying about our processing. Some of them weren't very kind. Some were very kind. It was funny to hear the descriptions sometimes. But good information, some of it on the rumor basis, some of it really good. But you'll know who's got a good in general reputation and not in general reputation, what things you should be looking for. Parent support groups, again, there's happens to be some great organizations out there that focus on after the children are back in the States, you know, with the heritage tours and neat stuff. But those are also great networks to find out who's been a reliable organization to work with. There's advocacy organizations out there, sort of umbrella organizations. Almost every agency is a member of something. Some coalition, some trade organization, some organization. You can ask what those umbrella organizations are. Sometimes they're called stakeholder organizations. Think about them. Get recommendations. Word of mouth. I mean, people in your church, in your school, in your community may have adopted. They may have had a good experience, a bad and indifferent one. Would you choose a realtor without doing any of this work? Would you choose a car dealership or get your transmission fixed without doing this due diligence? I'm surprised sometimes when people have bad experiences with adoption agencies. I ask them, how did you look into them ahead of time? They said, I have Yellow Pages, or they were advertised. This is a very important decision you're going to undertake. Make sure you're going to be working with someone who's really good. Hey, complaint registry. Now, not all agencies need to be Hague accredited, especially if they're working in South Korea, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan. They may never have sought Hague accreditation, and they might be just fine. But this is that the agencies that were accredited did reach the only federal standard there is. So it's worth looking at that, especially if you happen to be choosing one of those. You can see. Look where the complaints about them. Call the Council on Accreditation, which accredits the vast majority of these, or if you happen to live in Colorado, the Colorado Department of Human Services. Really good resource. Keep in mind, the Hague accredited agencies operate in a lot of countries. You guys are accredited, right? What non-convention countries do you work in?
Ukraine,
Honduras.
Pakistan.
Okay. So, think about that. And again, adoption.state.gov. If you have any specific, questions, basically ask ci@state.gov is the best way to get to us, and we get you right to the country officer. We are really a little bit downstream. USCIS is going to be where you start in the U.S. government process, but we're happy to. You can get a lot of the framework navigation off of our website. And actually, USCIS has done a great job in upgrading their website. If any of you did this 3 years ago versus now, they've come a long way, and they've got a good team over there. For convention, the National Benefits Center, and they're going to be consolidating more and more adoption cases at the National Benefits Center, even non-convention, which I think is a good thing because they've got a good team out there. So, main points, adoption.state.gov. Did I say that yet? understand there are two systems out there, basically. One with greater safeguards, one that doesn't necessarily have as the same safeguards, but in some countries are still very good. Know that there's an overall decline in inter-country adoptions. Demand from the United States still seems to be very high. Know that that means you're more likely to find an older or a special needs kid. I was going to ask, I like engaging.
Waiting times
are up. What is, and you guys are forbidden from answering this, what is, in your mind, the image of the typical adoptee from China? Pardon?
Baby girl.
Yeah, fairly, not necessarily newborn, but a baby girl. Healthy or special needs? Well, traditionally, if you go back a decade, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, and that's the image, the little Chinese girls who's in, actually my daughter's best friend was adopted in China 6 years ago, and as a 9-month-old. That must have been really at the very bottom end of the age spectrum back then. They're great together. That's not the typical adoptee from China anymore. Right now, as my statistics are always a little bit behind, I'm using the figure 40% of the adoptees from China right now are coming from what they call the waiting child program, which by definition is special needs or older kids. 40%. Had some meetings with the Chinese Central Authority, and it's clearly that proportion's going to increase. The waiting time for you guys can't answer. What is the waiting time now for a healthy Chinese young child? It's approaching 4 years. You put your paperwork in probably over 3 years before that child's born. Yeah, it's certainly growing. However, if from the waiting child program is it's 40% probably, a month and a half ago. I've heard people say it's going to come to be 80%. My crystal ball's not that fine-tuned, but it is definitely going to increase. I think we'll be above 50%. If we're not already, we will be very soon, and it's only going to increase. So what does that mean if you were committed to adopting from China? Well, if you started the process thinking you're going to get that beautiful, perfect baby girl from China, you're going to be waiting a long time, or it's going to be something different. The child's going to be perfect anyway, but that child may be older or may have certain special needs that you as a parent need to be prepared to work through with your child, whether that's extra medical care or certain parenting skills that that you need to acquire. And the way you get those is to making sure you have a good support network and good services. Yeah. We've got not a lot of time. Sorry. I don't actually know what time this ends, but I am here until you guys are done asking questions. And if you want to, you know, buttonhole me at lunch, I'm available for that too. And if you want to ask particulars about countries, I'd be happy to talk about that as well.
Can you speak to what's going on in Uganda?
Yeah.
A lot of
interest. Yeah. It's Uganda, yeah, and especially the agency would know. Uganda is one of those countries that does a custody order. You don't get a full and final traditionally in Uganda. A senior judge informed the embassy that those custody decrees are not for the purposes of inter-country adoption. And here's the dilemma. A strict legal interpretation, yeah, they would fit the legal definition for an IR-4 visa. Our lawyers have said it's not super clear, but they can fit in. But once we get that statement from the Ugandan judge saying, no, that's not what they're for, we have to revisit whether, you know, basically the Ugandan authorities saying, no, you're not supposed to take these children out. This is for, so that these American citizens or foreigners can live in Uganda with this child and then take the child on vacations or something. So almost as if, yeah. And that's distressing to us because, again, first off, that we know that there's a lot of kids in need, and we know that there's a lot of kids who have benefited from inter-country adoption from Uganda. Can't ignore what the judge is saying. Now, one, is the judge talking out of school? So what we've done is gone forward with a direct clarification with the Ugandan government for a legal determination, which is true. And that's where we're at right now with Uganda. In the meanwhile, a couple of families have gotten into a really tough bind. Yeah. Russia's a difficult place to adopt from, let's face it. The bureaucracy there is Russian. It's thick. It's hard. And there is a strong anti-inter-country adoption sentiment there. Now, it is adoption is not is very is still a fairly new social concept there. It's always existed, but it's not been the child was somehow not the same as your child. So they're getting over that somehow. Domestic adoption is increasing in Russia, and with that, the acceptance, I think, of adoption is somewhat increasing. But there is deep suspicion of foreigners wanting to come to the country for a couple of reasons. You know, you've got these mythical urban legends about horrible things happening to children when they come to are taken away. Since it's not a socially, it's still a newer concept there, there's that suspicion. Why? Well, we don't want these kids. Why would they? And you can kind of, you know, dismiss that as not necessarily significant until then you have the large number of children who have been killed by their adoptive parents, their American citizen parents, who have been abused to the point where the children will never cognitively function. Not dead, though. The sexual abuse cases, the pornography cases, it's not, I wish we could dismiss it, their suspicions solely on old wives' tales and cultural acceptance, but they have some empirical basis to base this on. So while it's fully legal in their country and, do you follow the Russian media very closely? Okay, there was an inter-country adoption there. No, I don't know. It's so bad. I'll tell you the worst inter-country adoption story I've ever heard in my life was in Russia with a Moldovan adoptive parent. And you'll be shocked. You'll probably want to sit down when I tell you this. I don't want to say it. But they've got all these bad stories to base it upon. So what you end up with is a long process with some fairly good safeguards within it, with the Ministry of Education and the Departments of Education. So you can have a fairly high level of confidence these children really are orphans, really have the parental rights have really been legally terminated. But at every stage, you're going to find people throwing up barriers. You know, my grandfather used to tell me, he said, Bill, there are excuses and there are reasons. Let's not confuse the two. You're going to find a lot of excuses given in the form of reasons of why you, at each stage. One of them, my favorite one, is they didn't like the U.S. apostilles. You're going to love this. There is a convention on international private law that says for the use of legal documents from one country into another, and uses the French term apostille. And there's a convention that governs this. The U.S. and Russia are members of this. The convention allows for certain things and prescribes certain things, but it's general. In it, it says you can actually attach them with a ribbon, because some countries do. And it says ribbons of multiple color, or ribbons of different colors. Some state, it might have been, do you know what state it was? One of the states had multiple colored ribbons, and that judge in Russia was rejecting it. So, excuses and reasons, you get that. You also get blocking in that way at various stages. The other thing that Russia has, however, is they have really very a lot of institutionalization there, and the children tend to come out of the institutional environments with special needs. Difficult in bonding with other people after something, and I'm not a developmental psychologist, and there are very good ones out there, and a good agency will be able to put you in touch with that network. But there's something about the first months of a child and the need for human contact, and if that doesn't happen, it's hard to recover from. And there's a lot of good studies on this, and oftentimes that's not happening in Russia. You also get a lot of drug use, fetal alcohol, drug use in from the birth parents in fetal alcohol syndrome, a lot of very difficult circumstances. Though that being said, they're wonderful, you know, wonderful, beautiful children, and they need families. So, and they're not finding the families in country. So, I think someday they will probably go the way of the convention, and I hope they do. I think they'd be a strong partner in the convention. Oh, really? With what? If you mind me asking? Oh, great. Okay, well, maybe we'll be neighbors. It looks like I'm going to be moving there in summer of 2011.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think that would be very suspicious of you trying to adopt while living in the
country? Not necessarily. As a matter of fact, I know of some people who have done just that. You're going to run up into some, you know, how you bring that child back, how you do the home study. You're going to run up against some, you're in like a legal hybrid case, kind of a inter-country adoption that's also a domestic adoption. So you're going to have extra homework to do.
Yeah. Is there a difficulty when, like, say, if we were returned to the United States?
What you would need to do is, depending on how it plays out in your timing, there are different definitions of child in the Immigration and Nationalities Act. If you live 2 years after you've achieved legal and physical custody of a child, if you've done 2 years overseas, you can bring that child back under a different subsection of the law. And it's actually, there's less paperwork involved, believe it or not. It's just then, is that okay with the country of origin? You know, normally what people do is they don't like, then you would want to, you got to weigh your circumstances. Some people don't want to do it that way. They want to go and do the whole process, get back to the States, get that citizenship for the child, and then go back overseas to continue their work overseas. So you got to weigh out the pros and cons. If you're patient and you're time overseas is long term, that's probably going to be okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. They are open, but they are extremely restrictive. So I think you have to be the grandparent, or it has to be either a sibling of a parent or a grandparent in order to adopt. I think cousins are considered too distant to adopt. It's they're just extremely restrictive. It's parked the whole question of, is that the best interests of the children? But they are, in fact, closed to the vast majority of people who want to adopt there, unless you happen to be a Romanian American who has an extremely close relative there. So, is it closed? Well, technically no, but functionally yes. I hope this is helpful. Our website was up there, and that's the best place. Things change all the time, so keep looking at it, especially our country updates. That's where you get the news. Great. Thank you very much.